Audi.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Every so often, a chance meeting ignites a spark that becomes a great burning flame. And when four young teenagers from Liverpool met and formed a band, yes, let's just ignore the Pete Best Ringo Starr thing for the sake of this introduction, okay? They would end up taking over the world, at least musically. Meanwhile, on the other side of the River Mersey, teenager Jennifer McGovern was fixing up her beehive and putting on her best home-sewn dress to begin her job processing claims in the legal department of the Blue Funnel shipping line, based just behind the iconic Liver buildings in the Liverpool docks. A journey that would mean getting the ferry across the Mersey every morning. A job that would see her at lunchtimes popping down to a nearby music venue called The Cavern. Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francescanand, and for today's episode, I am in Liverpool with my mum and my children, tracing the early days of the Beatles, catching the ferry and hearing all about the excitement of the era and the trials and tribulations of following the Beatles around, being their friend, and also of being a mixed race couple in the early 60s. This is from my lovely mum, who was there, and this is her story. Jennifer Nand was just a young teen when the Beatles were at the start of their meteoric rise, piling into her friend Jenny's hearse to go watch the bands, hitching lifts home through the Mersey Tunnel, being accidentally spat on the nose by none other than John Lennon, watching the debut performances of some of the UK's and indeed the world's most brilliant acts, rebelling on the Mersey ferry, controversially dating and then marrying my Indian Fijian dad, and much, much more. Jennifer Nand is on the Big Travel Podcast.
So we're standing outside the Cavern, although this isn't the original spot of the Cavern, isn't it? I think it's just over the road.
Yeah. Well, it's the same street down here.
Take this down because it's rattling. There we go.
Oh. I think that possibly is it. I'm not sure.
What was this like in the 60s?
Oh, it was amazing. The atmosphere was tremendous. We worked just around the corner, and myself and my friends used to come here when the Beatles were playing, but we came when Jerry and the Pacemakers were playing, and Dion and the Belmonts and the Swinging Blue Jeans. They all played here. It was amazing. No alcohol served, and the place was full of smoke, but it was, and we used to go back to the office stinking of smoke, but it was fun. We had a great time. And if we came at night, we were able to stand outside the Mersey Tunnel and thumb a lift home. And whoever we got in the first car that stopped for us, no trouble at all. Drop Hazel off at Bebbington, me at Bromborough, and another friend, Carol, at Eastham. So it was fantastic time to be alive and enjoy yourself, freedom. It was great.
So what was the idea behind lunchtime gigs and concerts? Because you don't really get a lot of that these days. Was it quite common?
It was common then in some of the clubs. It was common, and it brought in money. You had to pay, so that it brought in money to the clubs, and that was good. Epstein was often down there. Scylla, so that's where we first saw Scylla. I didn't hear her sing until she came to Birkenhead at the Majestic, and they introduced her, because of course she was very friendly with them. They introduced her as she, well, then she was Priscilla White. No, I think she changed then to Scylla Black, but she was originally, and she belted out Summertime, and it was amazing. Everybody stood still to listen to her voice. It was a good time to be 18.
Did you have any direct interaction with the Beatles?
Yes, you could talk to them. They'd come off stage. And then my friend Jenny, she had a group called Jenny and the Tall Boys. And their touring car was a hearse. So we used to go around in the hearse, which drew everybody's attention at the club door. Then we followed them. Oh, yes. We followed them to Helsby Hills. We used to go around wherever they went, if it was local, and if somebody had a car, because don't forget, very few people had cars in those days. And at Helsby Hills, where they sang, I can't remember what song it was, but a little blob of spit came on my nose from John. Very few people up there. It was stuck at the top of the hill in Cheshire. But good days.
John Lennon spat on your nose.
Yeah, John Lennon spat on my nose.
Did he notice? Like,
no, he didn't notice. John didn't notice anything in his own little world. But it was great. Really enjoyed it.
And your friends were friends with them. You were all friends with them.
Yes, yeah. My work colleague Linda, she lived in the same street as Paul, and Jenny from Jenny and the Tall Boys, because they used to come on before the Beatles came on. So they were all backstage. I can't say in dressing rooms, because it was just a little place. There was no dressing rooms at that time.
Describe the atmosphere out front in the cavern.
Oh, it was crazy. Everyone jumping up and down, smoke-filled room. It was wonderful. And we, at that time, we didn't really know. Well, we didn't know at all that they were going to be famous. So I remember the first time they played their first record. I was in the bath and my mum shouted, she said, "Listen, listen, they're on the radio." And we switched it up loudly. And to us, it was just, you know, just our friends playing music on the radio. But then it really took off when they did the rooftop in London and everything. It was good.
So it must have been incredible watching their meteoric rise after they left here.
Was
that,
yeah.
When you were watching them in the cavern, I can't remember, was that before or after the Hamburg days?
That was mostly after I saw them, after the Hamburg days. And Pete Best was drumming, first of all, there. And then I'm not sure if it was the first time Ringo played, but it was at the Iron Door Club that all my friends were all there. And Ringo was, if it wasn't the first time he played, he was fairly new. And they kept on saying, "Do you know this one, Ringo? This is a good one, Ringo. Do you know this one?" Which was a bit unfair. But
he seemed to know them.
Oh, absolutely. He knew it. They were just joking. That was when the Twist was around, Chubby Checker, and the Twist had just, because they were all twisting the night away. It was good. And then I remember that night specifically, we walked to the Mersey Tunnel and got a lift through the tunnel.
From some random stranger.
Yeah, from any first person that stopped there. Anybody stopped and had a chat with them, and it was good.
What would you be wearing at that time?
Oh, a miniskirt. I'd be in quite a short miniskirt, maybe knee-length boots. But we had some great outfits. I know the girls these days think they did, but we had some great... And I used to make my own clothes then, so I wish I'd have kept them, or at least taken a photograph, but nobody had a camera. I remember one specific time I'd been to the cavern and I had a beehive hairstyle. And I suppose she was a human resources lady. And she called me into the office. And I'd just come back from a holiday in Mallorca. So I was very, very brown. And the wind had blown my beehive. So it was about 12 inches tall on my head. And she said, "Jennifer, do try to be a little exotic, little less exotic." And I said yes. And then she said, "Could I not tie my hair back and have a bun at the nape of my neck?"
I always wish that in some of the old footage of the cavern, because there is old footage that, you know, you'd been there. I'm guessing that you never remember the a camera being there.
No, I never remember any cameras or any publicity or anything like that.
So it wasn't just the Beatles, was it? It was,
no.
You saw just an amazing array of fans.
Exactly. Some of them became famous, others faded away. It was good.
So you would, at the time, your life, you were getting, because you weren't living in Liverpool, you were getting
I was living in Bromborough.
Bromborough on the Wirral on the other side. So you'd be getting the ferry across the Mersey, famously,
yes,
in the morning.
Yes, we used to get the ferry, get the bus from Bromborough to Woodside Ferry, run down. We were always late. Run down, depending on the tide, if the, what do you call it, the way...
Causeway?
No. The ramp that goes to the boat. It was, if the tide was low, it was very steep to run down. If it was tide was high, it was an upward run, and we it was like 4 old pence to go on the boat. And round the top deck, the businessmen, then they all had umbrellas and bowler hats. Some had bow ties, and they used to walk around reading the Times or the newspapers, all walk around in the one direction. But myself and my friends would be very annoying and very childish, probably, and walk around in the opposite direction and interrupt their morning walk around the top deck.
Well, we're going to go to the Beatles Museum. Apparently there is one, we're standing outside one right here next to the cavern on Matthew Street. But we're going to go to a bigger and better one, apparently, down on the Albert Dock.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's do that now.
Let's go.
Bye.
We just saw the Beatles Story Museum, and it's wonderful, really good. Takes you through the whole experience from the very early days to what they did next. And, boys, what did you think of the Beatles Story?
It was good.
Yeah, it was good. We saw, like, John Lennon, we saw Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr, like, quite a lot.
What, and what was your favourite part of it?
I think it was about the wars, like the World War Tour and, like, other stuff like that.
Sebi, what was your favourite part of the Beatles Story?
I'm not sure.
Can you invent something?
No.
And we're now in the queue to get the ferry across the Mersey. Officially across the Mersey.
To see our great granny dying because she was 99.
We're going to mine and my mum's hometown of Bromborough on the Wirral.
She died when she was 99.
She did. My lovely nan died when she was 99. But this is the ferry that my mum used to get to and from work every day over to the, from the Wirral to Liverpool, from Birkenhead to Liverpool and back again. What was it like back then, mum?
Oh, it was cold, but it was enjoyable. It was better than being on the train, and it was much cheaper. And our building, India Buildings, was just 3 minutes walk away across the road. And it was cold now.
It's
very cold
now. Also, our granny is a big story. She was in World War II in our house.
Yes, she was. We're going to go see the house where my mum was born, actually, in the house. And I think what Elliot wanted to say there was my mum was born in the middle of an air raid. And Uncle Neil was born in an air raid in 1942. And you were born in 1943. In the house there, in the middle of the war.
2014.
There wasn't a war when I was born.
Probably was somewhere in the world in 2012 and 2014.
I'm not, I don't have a voice changer.
It's busy actually because it's half term at the moment. So as a travel journalist, I've been on 4 or 5 different radio stations already, including the Jeremy Vine show on BBC Radio 2. I'm scheduled to go on ITV News.
Just been in one.
I've just been on one. And also I'm doing the round of the local BBC radio stations, so probably about 10 BBC radio stations. This is all while sightseeing, going around the museums, getting the ferry across, seeing old friends and family, looking after 2 children and my mother.
You're not looking after me.
I'm not looking after her. And recording this episode.
Childcare is stressful.
Childcare is stressful, you're right. Sitting here on the top deck in the sunshine now. I mean, it's still a bit chilly, but this is the deck you used to walk around.
Oh,
was
me.
It? Yes, you.
seats?
Yes, yes.
It's really big.
But the seats weren't it's here, really obviously. Big. So they just used to walk around the perimeter and we used to annoy them.
I can't believe that people were still in bowler hats when you were working.
Yes, 60s, yeah. Mostly the executives. And they rolled umbrellas. They used to march like that with them, flicking them up. And the newspapers. They always had a newspaper under one arm, pinstripe suit. So don't forget, there were a lot of lawyers around then and solicitors in the city.
That's the clock on the Liver building, striking 1 o'clock. And that is the time that our ferry leaves, so hopefully we'll be heading out soon. I'm wondering if they're going to toot the horn. What's the horn called on a boat?
I don't know.
The funnel, whatever it is. I actually remember being in my nan's house in Bromborough, which is a few miles from here. And we were just about to go to bed. I used to go and stay with her really often. I was really lucky. And we spent a lot of time together. And she said to me, she said, "Oh, did you hear that? That means there's a big boat, or a ship rather, on the Mersey." And I heard nothing. She had better hearing than I did, even until she was 99. Come on, toot the horn.
Welcome aboard one of the most famous ferries in the world. Please pay attention to the emergency procedure notices displayed around the vessel. In the unlikely event of an emergency, you will hear 7 short blasts followed by 1 prolonged blast on the whistle. If you hear this signal, please make your way to the life jacket assembly points, following the assembly station direction signs displayed.
Good morning. I know you've all been welcomed aboard once, but I'd like to welcome you aboard again. My name is Jean, and I'm just going to be telling you a few things about what you're going to see as we are on our way. Now, did you know that there's been a ferry across the Mersey for more than 800 years? And it's provided a link between this side and that side, between Liverpool and Wirral. We're just leaving Pierhead. And this takes its name from the long stone pier, which once jutted out into the river from the shore next to the Sailor's Church. Now, the Sailor's Church, if you glance to the right...
Back end, because the tide pushes the boat in, you see it's safer. And plus, it's the biggest area.
Don't go in the grass. The messy line. It's about to fall.
That is going to come down.
With a bang.
With a bang.
With a bang.
Could you not have tooted the horn?
No, that's talking to the other boat, you see.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's a mean summer.
Got you. Right, stand back from the... Gangplank down, we're getting off. Thank you.
See you now.
Thank you. And we're on the Wirral. Over here on the Wirral, it's a much different atmosphere to Liverpool. That's always been a very busy and bustling port. And what was it like growing up on the Wirral in the 50s and 60s?
Yes, it was well, where we lived, it was a quiet area. Nothing much happened. There were a few coffee bars. There was one coffee bar in Bromborough Village. It was built on an old pub. They knocked the pub down and built a coffee bar. And we used to go and hang around there. And very few of us had enough money for 2 coffees. But we'd have a coffee and just sit around there till it was time, till we all had to be in, usually at 9:30. my next door neighbour, he was a little bit older than me, and he had a friend that had a motorbike. So then the motorbike came, but that was probably when I was 15, 16. There were a lot of motorbikes, and they were good guys. They had jobs, but because they had motorbikes and leather jackets, they were frowned upon, which was ridiculous. But I wasn't allowed to go on the back of anybody's motorbike, but I did. And one of my closest friends, probably I'd call him a boyfriend, I don't know, he had a nice Triumph 650, so we used to go on that often. And then some days, particularly on Sundays and Saturdays, we would walk down to a place called Raby Mere, beautiful lake with boats on it, and we'd all congregate there, much to the probably annoyance because the motorbikes would come down. But we just park there and talk. Nothing wrong with that, but it was frowned upon.
The going on the motorbikes when you weren't allowed, the walking around the opposite way of the men on the ferry was not the only rebelling you did. Probably the biggest rebelling or the most controversial thing you did was meet my dad.
Oh, yes, your dad. Mm. I don't see it as rebelling. I just fell in love with him. I don't see it as rebelling. I should point out here that he's of Indian extract, born in Fiji, brought up in Fiji. But the British took the Indians, they told them they were going around the corner from Calcutta to some other place to work. And they ended up miles, thousands of miles away in Fiji, where they became indentured labour and slaves, basically. They were treated very, very badly. A lot of them died on the way there because of not measles, it was just coughs and colds that they weren't used to. And one boat in particular capsized. A lot of them were lost. But that's how the Indians arrived in Fiji and have been there ever since. There's an awful lot of history attached to that.
So Dad was it 1959 or 1960? 1960. Dad found his way from New Zealand and via the States to Southampton. If you haven't listened to the episode with my dad, Chris Nand, do have a listen, because it's quite something, the way he, a little boy from Fiji, an Indian Fijian boy, wound up on the south coast of the UK, found his way up north because when he was in Fiji, he'd met a kind man who was his boss, I do believe, in the factory there, who said, if you ever want to come to England, here is my parents' address in the Wirral. And my dad wrote to them and was taken in by them and found his way here.
Mm.
And what was your first encounter with him?
We were both very keen gym people. He went to a gym in Wallasey and I went to the ladies' part and saw him there, and we said hello, but his English wasn't... He won't like this. It was a bit poor. And then we had a date, and that was it. It wasn't that easy. My father threatened to cut me off of all inheritance and all that nonsense.
That sounds like you come from like a family with inheritance.
There was no inheritance at that point. No, at that point there was nothing.
Well, there wasn't any. We're a working class.
No.
Well, so you were the only girl in school that wasn't at the council estate, weren't you?
Most of them were on the council estate, in the junior school, in the senior school. That was a different kettle of fish. It was in Bebington.
Yeah, of course, at Wirral Grammar, it was all much more respect. I wasn't saying your early schooling wasn't respectable, but what I was saying was there was no inheritance. Your dad was a manager in a factory.
Stork
factory, and they were working class made good, weren't they?
Yes, still very, yes, he worked hard.
Very lower middle class, and your mum, my lovely Nan, was brought up with her sister and their mum, who was a single mum taking in washing because she was a widow, because her husband, Nan's dad, had been killed in the First World War in 1917.
And you have to remember at that time, it was my father's opinion, and Chris appreciated that and would never go against it, but there was still apartheid, well, in South Africa, but in America, there was still total segregation in the 60s, total. I mean, they couldn't, well, Rosa Parks, everybody knows that story about on the bus, but yeah, there was total segregation. So I suppose he had a right to worry about me, but I wasn't particularly worried, and we were together for about, we could never live together, wouldn't have done that then. Never on holiday together, we were never allowed to be together, and my father would stand on the doorstep at 11 o'clock on the dot, waiting for me to get off the last bus, which Chris saw me to the door, but he would never acknowledge him. But that's how it was. So that was my father probably had a, not a right, but he had cause to worry that I wouldn't, that would end up, I don't know, in some ghetto, I don't know. He never discussed his feelings with me. Strangely enough, his mother, who was alive, encouraged me.
She was a bit of a rebel.
She was definitely a bit of a rebel. Very, I would say she was very left-wing.
Like it?
You like it. I always remember her saying that one day, and this is in the late 50s, one day we won't have corner shops. We'll have big places in the country, and everyone will have a car and go and do their shopping. Mm. Big markets, or they weren't called supermarkets. They didn't exist. Big places in the country where you'd go and shop for a week. So she was
clever.
If she'd have been educated, she would have been very clever.
So she approved of your marriage to Dad,
yeah.
But your own father didn't go to the wedding.
No.
And your mother, my nan, was only really had to sneak out there under pain of being excommunicated herself.
Yes. He said if she goes to the wedding, he would never allow her in the house again. I'm talking about the wedding, the honeymoon as such, if you could call it a honeymoon. We went to St. Asaph in Wales, a place that I love. It's a nice little place. But nobody would let us in. We were not, and it was freezing cold. It was January. And we knocked on several bed and breakfast, I suppose. And they said, no, we're full up. And then the last one, we tried three or four. And the last one we went to, the lady said, oh, yes, come in. And then she told us where to go for a meal. But I was worried because I thought my mother wouldn't be allowed back in the house. But she was.
He needed someone to cook his dinner.
Yeah, make his sandwiches. She was allowed back in the house. But he didn't talk to us for about 10 years. And initially, she wasn't allowed to talk to us. So any telephone conversation, by that time we'd had a phone installed in the house, any telephone conversation was like secret code. I'd say, hello, and she would answer, oh, it's a lovely day, isn't it? It was very, very difficult. And then for the first 5 years, we didn't have children. And then Lisa and Marcus came along, and he didn't thaw. He didn't. He treated them. Well, he didn't see them. But
that's me, by the way.
Oh, that's the interviewer.
He thawed with us, didn't he?
Yes, but when he was older.
He
was getting, well, I won't say senile, but he just became more tolerant.
And I'd see him be so kind when he came to visit us in Spain. He'd be so kind that his face would light up when he spoke to little children.
Mm.
And I just never, ever saw him look at us that way. And it was interesting for me. I was only young at the time, but I'd noticed the way he treated other children, children, differently.
Yes. Yeah.
Very differently.
Definitely. And then, of course, we had the problem of finding somewhere to live. That was very difficult. We'd see an ad in the newspaper and we'd phone up and they'd say, oh, yes, come along. And we'd be standing in a phone booth because we didn't have mobile phones, of course. We'd be standing in a phone booth watching the house and the person would say, yes, come along. And we go knock at the door and they say, oh, sorry, it's just been let. We've just let it. Sorry, we don't have any more. So it was very difficult to find somewhere to live. Eventually, we knocked at the door. Again, it was a lovely Catholic lady, which had happened, if you see Lisa's podcast when her father was doing it. A nice Catholic lady let us in the house, and we lived in a room. It was a nice room, but it was so cold, and we had an electricity meter that took about 2 old shillings to even cook a meal. It was cold. And we just saved and saved and saved and saved, and eventually got our own house.
A very big, nice house, by all accounts. I remember, what was that encounter with Grandad when he came round to fix something, when you were just getting back in touch with him?
Oh, yes, there was a leak somewhere, and we had no idea how to fix it. We'd not long moved in, and nobody could come, and neighbours couldn't help. So I had to ask him. And his face, when we saw where we were living, it was a picture. He didn't say anything. He wouldn't say anything. He just fixed the leak, and off he went. But he was very surprised to see where we live. It wasn't a mansion, but it was a very nice house.
What, going back to how we started this this particular episode, we were partying in Liverpool, in Matthew Street, in the Cavern, in the 60s. So you took Dad to all those places, didn't you? You went to those places together.
Yes.
And how was he received by the young people?
Oh, very well. He was adored. I mean, he always has been. Well, he's polite. He was very, very handsome. He was stunning, wasn't he? You don't remember.
I've seen pictures, though. He's very handsome. And well, so are you. You're a very good-looking couple.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.
Maybe you're a very striking couple, seeing your wedding photos, you getting married in your white leather coat and him with his lovely suit. You designed yourself.
Yes. No, we went to the Beachcomber was one place in particular. All the Everton footballers were there, because he's an Everton supporter. So he was just chatting to them, and we were dancing, and then we went to these clubs. I did go a lot with my girlfriends, because he's not the world's best dancer. Can you edit that? That's a bit mean.
I get my dancing skills from you.
But I love to dance, and I do dance a lot, given the opportunity. But, I've been married now 55 years, coming up 56 years. So married life is not easy sometimes. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But we've survived, and I have to say, moving to Spain, that we don't encounter any prejudice there, whether there is any underlying prejudice, but people just accept you for who you are, what you've got, if you're a good person, and that's it. It has been. I'm sure underneath there might be some prejudice, but it's not obvious. It's definitely, whereas in England, there was a lot of, in the 60s, a lot of prejudice. Particularly with our eldest, our son, Marcus, at school he was being picked on. There was himself and another boy that was mixed race. This is before Lisa started school. They were being picked on and taunted because of their colour, and their very nice brown colour. And it was then that Chris decided that we were going somewhere. We'd been doing a little bit of buying and selling property in Spain. And he'd been over to Fuengirola, and he said, it's a great place. He said, nobody cares who you are, what you've got. And he said, for the first time in many, and I remember this, many, many years, he said, I can walk down the street with my head in the air. Nobody even looks at me or talks or anything, whispers behind his back. So we packed up and went. We had 5 suitcases and we went, couldn't afford the flight. So we went on the bus, 3 days on the bus.
I remember it well. I was 7 years old and I travelled with my rag doll on my knee all the way. And Marcus was 9 years old and he had a guitar. that he picked up along the way, and the rest is history. And if you want to listen to what happened next for my mum and dad, they had an amazing, well, we continue to have an amazing life and connection in Spain and have travelled quite extensively. I do listen to my dad's episode of the podcast. I did a Father's Day special a couple of years ago and interviewed dad about all his travels and how he felt coming from Fiji to the north of England and then everything he's done since. You've been to so many countries, Cuba, you love going to India, you love travelling around the States, going back to Fiji, Australia, New Zealand. But actually, probably most magical in my memories of travel with you was our travels around the south of France and Europe in a camper van when I was younger, because my dad worked in Vauxhalls and he had some car knowledge and skills, but you used to buy camper vans and have them kitted out and made into...
Empty vans
and made from auction and made into a camper van. And that was really, those days were really magical. But... And then, of course, through your work, you've travelled extensively.
I've been, well, we lived in Turkey, we lived in Mallorca, and then we've travelled to Montenegro, Moscow, Ekaterinburg in Russia.
Israel, Egypt.
Israel, Egypt, so many lovely places, Peru, Cuba, so many places, I can't recall them all.
In fact, I must get my travel bug from you and Dad, because my first ever holiday, I was 6 weeks old.
Yes.
And we went to North Wales.
Yeah.
And it rained all the time we were there, and I cried the whole time as well. My travels have got better since. But anyway, so if you want the full story about Mum, Dad and the travels, do listen to Dad's episode, Chris Nand. I forget what number it is, but it's there somewhere. But to finish this episode, I always ask people about a music question. And I'm assuming you know, because you do listen to my podcast.
I do listen to your podcast, yes.
Not even under duress.
No.
And I'm going to ask you to pick a song. And I'd like you to take you back to Liverpool and that time of the 60s, because that's why we're here on this little nostalgia tour. If you had to pick a memory, one song that particularly takes you back to that time, what is that song and what is the memory?
Well, thinking of it now, it is The Hollies, that played many times at the Cavern, The Air That I Breathe. That's and strangely enough, Lisa and I went to see them last Saturday night in Brighton Civic Centre, and they sang it. It was the finale song, and I just love it. I love the guitar. It just conjures up so many memories of so many different places, because I've heard it all over the world. So that would be. But then I do like the classics as well, Debussy and some arias. I have many favourite arias from the opera. So difficult to name just one, but I would say, dating back, as this is about the 60s, 70s as well, that would be my number one song.
Did you see The Hollies in the Cavern and in...
Yes. Yeah. See The Hollies. Oh, well, we've said the Swinging Blue Jeans, the Farron and the Flamingos.
Oh, I love Farron. Farron and the Flamingos. My goodness. What happened to them? Who doesn't love them?
Oh,
Billy
so many.
Fury, Billy the statue Fury. Of Billy Fury down in the in the Albert Dock. And Elliot got him. I should have totally called him Elvis. Elliot, my seven-year-old, got a bit obsessed. He was like, when did Billy Fury die? And who was he? And I was like, to be honest, I don't know much about him.
One of my favourites. He was really a favourite. The last time we booked to see him was at the Empire. It was big. Lots of people on the show, but he was ill. He had suffered very bad health all his life, basically, and he was ill. So we were all queuing outside, and then a notice came up to say it was cancelled. I don't think he toured anymore after then.
Well, I know from reading the statue yesterday on the Albert Dock that he died in 1983, I think it was, or 84, possibly the early 80s, aged just 43.
Yes, he was very young, but he was very good.
And your standout memories of the Beatles?
Oh, I don't know. It's just, I mean, there were so many memories to think about and so many good times, you know, no drugs or, well, I don't know what else everybody else was doing, but we didn't know anything about drugs. It was all so free and easy and comfortable. It was just great. But I don't know, so many Beatles numbers, I couldn't say. My memories of them, playing in the Majestic in Birkenhead when Cilla first went, but they're an amazing group, and the you know, they started off with just the four of them, their guitars. There was no technology then. It was just good, basic music that they wrote and they played. And the lyrics, of course, are very, very good.
Oh, God, I've just thought of one. One of my first Beatles memory, because the Beatles are my favourite band in the world, but I came to them after we'd moved to Spain, and I didn't come to them through you know, I came to them like many teenagers come to music that their parents love, and they go, have you heard of this great band called the Beatles? I didn't actually say that, but you were like, yes, I know who they
are. Your brother did.
Yeah, my brother did. He was a musician. I was into them before he was. That's my claim to fame. I got them into earlier. It was like, he was later. It was like, have you heard of the Beatles? But my first Beatle related memory was, of course, the death of John Lennon.
Was it really?
Yes, because I was only 6, and it was on the 8th of December 1980, wasn't it? So I was only 5 or 6, and just the year before we moved to Spain. And I just remember all of you being absolutely devastated and watching the news, which of course was only on, you know, we didn't have all day TV, or at least of all day news at that point. And just watching that, well, we went to the Beatles experience, the Beatles story, it's called, down at the Albert Dock today, and the replica of that, the white room with the white piano that he played Imagine in, and just watching that video over and over again, and you guys just being absolutely devastated, both my mum
and you'd dad. Already suffered the death of Elvis. You were upset about the death.
No, I didn't remember it. Marcus remembers it. Yeah.
Marcus was too little. You were too little.
He remembers the death of Elvis.
Yes, he cried on his way to school.
Anyway, I was going to think of a happier way to end it. The Hollies, the air that I breathe. And we saw them just a few days ago at the Brighton Centre.
They're amazing. Excellent show. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks, Mummy.
Hope it turns out all right. I'm
sure it will. Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you'd enjoyed our little family step back in time as much as I did. Please like and subscribe so then you can get a brand new episode of the Big Travel Podcast pop into your hand every fortnight. See you soon.